You're listening to The Globalist, first brobroadcast on the 17th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 10 a.m. in Tbilisi, 8 a.m. in Capri, 7 a.m. here in London and 2 a.m. in Toronto. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, G7 foreign ministers meet in Capri. What's on the agenda and how unified are the leading liberal democracies? Violence breaks out in Parliament in Georgia whilst protests rock the streets. We'll be in Tbilisi to find out why. We'll cross to South Africa to get details on the new health insurance bill. And then we're at Salone del Mobile to meet the team at luxury appliance manufacturers Gaggenau to talk about their design approach.
What we can do is we can offer an assortment of products which can be combined in different ways, which can be built in different situations. The architects have a lot of flexibility in order to do their project.
We'll have a roundup of the front pages and the latest television news, and then we'll check in with our woman in Paris 100 days before the Olympics. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The US and its allies plan fresh sanctions against Iran over its unprecedented attack on Israel, seeking to dissuade a major escalation. Myanmar's detained former leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from prison to house arrest. And Haiti's government has named the members of a transitional council set to take power when Prime Minister Ariel Henry steps down, inching closer to putting in place measures that could restore security in the violence-wracked country. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, a G7 foreign ministers meeting will begin in Capri today, running until Friday. According to authorities, the goal is to strengthen the role of the G7 as the main forum for dialogue among leading liberal democracies and as a driver of stability to face major global crises. Well, I'm joined here in the studio by Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow with the European Programme at Chatham House, and down the line by Sara Bazoum, who is Marie Curie Fellow at the Giga Institute of Middle East Studies and Associate Research Fellow at Italy's ISPI. Welcome to you both. Quentin, if we could just begin with those stated aims, that the G7 comprises Italy, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, the United Kingdom and the United States, as well as the EU. How united are these countries in the face of all that's going on in the world? Is the G7, as they say, indeed the main forum for dialogue?
Well, I think it's the only one they've got at the moment, and they are united about one thing, which is they're desperate to prevent a serious escalation of violence beyond where it is in the Middle East. On the other hand, they're not entirely united, perhaps, about Ukraine, the other disastrous conflict that they're facing, where the US has been seriously dragging its feet, really, on the next round of reinforcements for Ukraine. So they've got one hell of an agenda, and it doesn't sound, when you think about them all meeting in Capri, it sort of sounds like it might be a holiday. It's going to be anything but a holiday.
Mm. Sara, they may be united, but can they have any influence over possible escalation in the Middle East?
I think they are really trying. They are trying hard. Germany's foreign minister spent a visit to Tel Aviv. British officials spent a visit to Tel Aviv. So everybody is trying desperately to convince the Israelis not to respond to the 12 April attacks by Iran. How much of an influence do they have on either side? I'm unfortunately not really too hopeful about it, because you know, there are various considerations on each side. Both Iran and Israel have had years of hostility towards each other. There is ideological issues involved. There is the sort of face-saving measures towards their local and regional constituents. And, of course, there is the re-establishment of the deterrence that is also being questioned. So I'm not really that hopeful about the level of influence that the G7 could have, but I'm also confident that they are really trying hard to de-escalate.
Quentin, the situation in the Red Sea is also on the agenda. What do we expect to come out of that discussion?
Well, they've obviously been helping each other. I mean, the US taking the lead in trying to counteract the Houthi rebels there. But this has very much been overtaken by Iran suddenly being directly involved in the conflict rather than indirectly via its allies around the region. And I think that is going to be the real test. Do they have the influence on either Israel or Iran to stop what is looking like a sort of inexorable drift to greater conflict?
Sarah, we understand that the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, and the Ukrainian foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, will be in Capri to discuss Russia's aggression. The West doesn't seem to be able to provide Kyiv with the weaponry it desperately needs. What will be the collective position on this?
You mean the collective position of the European G7 countries towards the conflict in Ukraine?
And providing weaponry and support.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, as Quentin earlier mentioned, there hasn't been a united front in that respect. And that's quite sad to see, especially with the US being the main provider of support, dragging their feet and delaying their support. Well, I see these two conflicts very much interlinked, the Ukrainians and the Israeli conflict. I don't believe that Iranians would have done that if they did not test their drones in Ukraine, if they did not have that sort of a strategic alliance that they have built with the Russians and with the Chinese, indeed, over the past years. The future of both events are very much interlinked. And as you know, so long as the West and the US sort of delay and a response and delay and sort of put up the appeasement strategy towards both Iran and Russia, I think all we're going to witness is more aggression, unfortunately, and more crisis.
But, I mean, Quentin, Europe is absolutely on the front line with this. I mean, Ukraine matters more, arguably.
Yes, I think so. In the long run, although these are both terrible conflicts too, and the fact that they clearly have an effect on each other, President Zelensky has just made very clear that actually what's been happening in Israel and the success of Israel's Iron Dome in actually shooting down almost the entire bunch of missiles that Iran had thrown at them, in Ukraine they have really not got anything like that in terms of air defence. So he's saying, look, this is precisely what we need. And if you go back to the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Israel refused to actually give Ukraine the technology for a better air defence against the Russians. So there's all sorts of, if you like, mistaken steps along this path. And I think Ukraine very much needs reinforcement at this moment.
Sarah, you were talking about China, and I wonder if China, and particularly China's conflict with Taiwan, will also be discussed.
Yes, definitely. I think these three, Ukraine, Iran, Israel, and generally, you know, the regional war around Israel and the issue of Taiwan have been on the mind of the policymakers in the West for a very long time. And I think everybody is very much convinced that at some point something will erupt in that front. And that would also be yet another shock to the global system and to how prepared the sort of Western liberal world is is and willing indeed to support or to push back against that kind of possible disaster scenario. It is definitely something that I'm very much following the development, and I know for a fact that it's serious consideration in the West and in G7 as well.
Quentin, Italy is president of the G7 at the moment, and Rome's made Africa a priority for its year at the helm. Why is that? What's the aim?
Well, it's very relevant, obviously, in Italy, because the conflicts in Africa, the problems in Africa, are directly behind the flow of migrants across the Mediterranean that is causing great nervousness in Italy. Having said that, there's another key reason. If we come back actually to the beginning of our conversation and say how relevant is the G7, the capacity of the G7 so-called liberal countries of the industrialized world to win the argument, for example, in Ukraine, indeed in the Middle East, are very complicated. There's a lot of sympathy in Africa for the Russian case in Ukraine. And indeed, what's happened in Gaza has also, if you like, reinforced that that desire among African countries to be on the other side. So actually, it could be a fairly critical moment in trying to win or at least shift that debate and win a bit more support in the southern part of the world, the African, the developing world, for the Western position.
Mm. Finally, Sarah, this is the first of two G7 foreign ministers' meetings to be held in Italy this year. How important is what's decided here? How and when might anything signed off at this meeting be implemented?
How it would be implemented is a matter of time. We all have to see to see how much action the decision makers are willing to put behind their words. But it's definitely an important platform, because if they manage to demonstrate a united front, then indeed translate that into tangible policy implications and tangible steps to support Ukraine or to push back against Iran or any other for that matter policy making and policy decision that they come up with would have a very lasting and very significant impact on the global dynamics. And if I may, I just wanted to add one quick 2 cents on what Quentin said about the sympathy in Africa. I couldn't agree with him more, but also we need to keep into consideration that there has been a lot of investment, disinformation, influence campaigns, cyber campaigns by Iran and Russia in Africa, and there is evidence to support that. So this sympathy is not just a natural, organic sympathy. Of course, there is history and there is colonial grievances and so on and so forth behind it. But the recent wave is very much driven by the influence campaign that these countries are running in that part of the world.
Sarah, thank you. That's Sarah Bazubanli and also Quentin Peel. This is The Globalist. Minutes past 10 in Tbilisi and 7:12 here in London. Now, thousands of people took to the streets in Tbilisi for a second day yesterday, demonstrating against the Georgian government's controversial foreign influence bill that critics say mirrors repressive Russian legislation used to silence dissent. Protesters in the former Soviet Republic are also concerned that the bill undermines Georgia's long-standing bid for EU membership. Well, I'm joined now by Rehan Dimitri, who's a BBC journalist covering the South Caucasus and Central Asia. Good morning to you, Rehan.
Good morning, Georgina. Good morning.
What exactly is this law?
Well, it's the second attempt by the Georgian government to pass the law. Last year, it was presented as the Foreign Agents Bill, and there were mass protests in March 2023, so the government was forced to cancel this law, and they backed off, and the society, the Georgian society, thought, okay, for now, that's it was a victory for people, and a lot of people were quite astonished, to put it mildly, when the government earlier this month, they said that they're going to bring this law back under a new title. So the new title is the transparency of foreign influence. And what it means is that any, it would target civil society organizations, non-governmental organizations, and independent media that receive more than 20% of their funding from foreign donors. They would have to declare themselves as an organization serving the interest of foreign power. If they refuse to do so, they'll be subject to a big fine. Also, every 6 months, the Ministry of Justice would have access to their internal communication and will be monitored by the Ministry of Justice. So what it means and why people feel so strongly against this law, first of all, you know, all the slogans so far, we've seen the second day of large protests yesterday, and the protest will resume at midday today. The main slogan is no to the Russian law, because, of course, the first association is with the existing law in Russia that was adopted in 2012, and since then expanded to crush any dissent in Russia. For those who follow Russian news, you get these updates almost every week from their Ministry of Censorship, or whatever it's called, when they designate more and more people as foreign agents. And that is reminiscent of Soviet times, when people were labeled as enemy of the state. So the why people are so against, because it's about labeling, it's about shrinking the space for freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And people are fighting because they believe it's absolutely existential. And of course, on top of that, most of Georgia's Western partners, and yesterday there was a statement from the, or on Twitter, on X, Charles Michel, the president of the European Council, he put it very, very clearly. And he said, look, the adoption of this law is absolutely inconsistent with Georgia's stated goal of joining the EU. It will not bring it closer to the EU, but further away.
Mm. And there's talk now of perhaps sanctions, EU sanctions.
I'm not aware of EU sanctions at this stage, but I think what's important to remind is that last December, Georgia was granted EU candidate status. This is something that this country was fighting for a long time. And there were big rallies last year in which Georgians, despite their government's actions, which the opponents of the government say have been pro-Russian since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, there were, you know, tens of thousands of people out in the streets kind of calling and on the EU and saying, look, we are Europe. Mm. We do not want to go back to Russia. And the country was granted this status. And when you talk to the government, you know, it's not that easy actually to get interviews with the government, but on those rare occasions when I had an opportunity to talk to them and I put these questions to them and they say, how can we be pro-Russian if we got this candidate status from the EU? But when I go back, you know, and I ask protesters and I say, you're calling this government pro-Russian, but they're saying that they want more transparency. Also, just to reflect on the government's position, on the Georgian government's position, this is an important year. And like in so many countries around the world, Georgia will have general elections sometime in early October. So this is seen as a preparation for the elections. Mm. The current government has been in power for three terms, already 12 years, which is unprecedented in independent Georgia. I mean, it's independent since Soviet times. And there's also kind of internal points here for the government. They just want to make sure that they have control over those who potentially might criticize them. And that is NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and independent media that hold the government accountable.
Mm. So, I mean, Georgia has traditionally been seen as a leader of democratic transformation amongst ex-Soviet countries. But in recent years, particularly under the Georgian Dream Party, it's been criticised for democratic backsliding. How close is the ruling Georgian Dream Party to the Kremlin?
Georgina, that is a million-dollar question. I don't think I can answer it, but I can just give you some facts. There is one very important and influential person in this country. His name is Bidzina Ivanishvili, and he's a billionaire. He's also the founder of Georgian Dream. He's been kind of in and out of politics several times, and his latest return was last around Christmas time in 2023. So he officially returned to politics. His current role is the honorary chairman of the Georgian Dream Party. And Mr. Ivanishvili made his wealth in Russia in the 1990s. Therefore, it's one of the arguments for the opposition, for the critics of this government, that this man is the actual ruler here and the government does what he says. Mm. Now, of course, if you put that to any senior politicians here, they would deny it. Of course, they all respect Mr. Bidzina Ivanishvili, and they talk about how you know, he's been in philanthropy. He's done a lot of good things for this country. But this kind of meddling and the influence in politics, which Transparency International, one of the NGOs targeted by the government, and I think this pushing this law is specifically to silence organizations such as Transparency International. So Transparency International says that there's a state capture because one man with so much power and so much money is having an influence on the politics in this country.
Rayan, just very quickly before you go, tell us about the punch-up in Parliament.
Right. It just shows how much like pictures matter, isn't it? Like, I think this video made really kind of headlines and everywhere. So what happened was there's an opposition politician from a small party called Citizens Party. His name is Aliko Elisashvili. And on the first day when this draft law was being discussed at the Legal Affairs Committee, he just punched in the face the head of parliamentary fraction from Georgian Dream, Mamukum Dinaradze. He has been the key person who reintroduced the law, and he's the kind of the face of reintroduction of this law. So Elisashvili punched him in the face, and that's what was captured on cameras. What happened afterwards, I saw him on the first day of the protest, and he had some visible bruises on his face. And he said that he was actually beaten up by pro-governmental MPs, but he kind of turned into a national hero, you know. And some people say, oh, it was just a populist move, you know, why did he do that? But his words were, he said that he did what a lot of Georgians feel like doing. And he was greeted by the protesters, even though, you know, nobody wants to glorify violence, given that there was more violence last night by the police against the protesters. And who knows what's going to happen today. But at least, you know, I've seen young people taking selfies with Elisashvili because they feel very strongly against this law. And they feel that he expressed what many people feel inside.
Rayan, thank you very much indeed. That's Rayan Dimitri. Now, still to come on the programme, we meet the team at home appliances manufacturer Gaggenau and talk about the power of heritage in kitchen design.
We try to do long-lasting things. We don't believe in changing designs, features of products on an annual or a biannual basis. We do this in a long-term perspective. So if you buy an oven, it should look great and it should work well in 20 years.
This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
is The Globalist on Monocle Radio with me, Georgina Godwin, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Yasmin Abdel-Majid, who is the Sudanese-Australian broadcaster and author. It's lovely to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Dubai, what's going on? The headline, storm dumps heaviest rain ever recorded in the UAE.
That's right. So about a year's worth of rain came crashing down from the sky Monday and Tuesday, which has caused intense flash flooding across the desert city. It closed down the airport. I mean, the airport essentially is now full of people because Dubai's airport, as we know, is I think the second busiest airport in the world. So flights have been delayed, not been able to move. You had individuals kind of leaving their cars in the middle of the highway because of the flash flooding. And so, I mean, Dubai is a city that gets about 100 mil of rain over a year, four inches in a year, and that's about what they got in the space of only a few hours. And you know, there are some reports that are saying that this sort of mass rain, these flash floods, are the result of climate change. And so when you have cities that are not built for this amount of rain in such a short period of time, these are the sorts of things that you'll see. So this may be the first time, but it may not be the last.
I mean, it's extraordinary just reading some of these details. And as you say, cars abandoned, looking at the pictures, the situation at the airport has been described as absolute carnage.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting when you read the reports because a lot of people don't want to be named because obviously it's quite, you know, freedom of speech in the country isn't a huge thing. And so you've got people, officials and so on, critiquing or pointing out that the situation is devastating, but also not being able to sort of actively speak out about it. Mm. What you also do have, though, is lots of individuals sharing on social media, posting videos of escaping their cars and sleeping in the airports and even in the metro stations. But it is shocking, and it'll be interesting to see whether there will be like a longer term change in infrastructure, whether this will be something that starts to be taken into account in planning and so on. Because, again, Dubai is not a place where they think about rain and they think about in terms of design. But if this is going to be something that continues to happen, it's going to have to be thought about.
Absolutely. Well, there may not be a lot of freedom of speech there, but at least you can still have a cigarette, which you may not be able to do here soon.
Right. And this is fascinating. So the Conservative government, Rishi Sunak, had his flagship smoking ban bill pass its first hurdle. So what this essentially is Rishi Sunak proposing that anyone who's born after a particular date in January 2009 will no longer be able to buy cigarettes. So that's about, if you're 15 years old. And what he wants to do is create a generation of non-smokers. This It was modelled off a New Zealand smoking ban, but New Zealand actually, even though it had passed it, it had actually not implemented it. So if this actually gets through the next level, if it goes through the House of Lords and actually gets passed, it will mean that England, the UK, will have one of the strictest smoking laws in the world. And it is, I think given the Conservatives tend to position themselves as small state, you know, not interested in being a nanny state and so on, it is an interesting position. I'm curious, Georgina, I mean, what do you think about a state deciding whether a generation of people should be allowed to smoke or not?
Do you know, I am a committed smoker, but I wish I wasn't.
Mm.
And had it just simply not been available to me, I don't think I would.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm not actually 100% against it. But it links to this other story about a smacking ban, and I don't really know how I feel about
right.
that either. But
it is quite interesting. This is again thinking about the children, as it were. And doctors in England and Northern Ireland are advocating for a ban of smacking children, full stop. And because they're sort of saying, you know, this links to child abuse, and they see all sorts of injuries and so on. And an article in The Guardian, I thought it was interesting. They said there are many, many countries, 65 countries have actually banned smacking, and 27 others had committed to doing the same. And so Northern Ireland and England are actually out of step with many countries in the world. But this was not something I had known. There is sort of a bit of a grey area in what constitutes smacking and also what is going to be the punishment for a parent that maybe, you know, smacks a child out of like as part of their discipline routine. I don't know, but I mean, clearly you can tell that I don't have children, so I'm not. But I do think that it's when you start to get the state involved in the minutiae of parenting and the minutiae of our lives. I mean, smoking might be one thing, but when you get them involved in, okay, what is your relationship between a parent and a child? I think it starts to get interesting.
Yeah. Have you read Christos Tsiaklos' The Slap?
Oh, yeah, the Australian. I've watched the show, actually, but I haven't read the book, I must confess. Yeah.
Well, if people are interested, in fact, he is the current guest on Meet the Writer. So if you just go to our website, you can listen to an interview I did with him in Australia recently. Now, let's talk about what was going on in Brussels.
That's right. So listeners might have been aware of, and this is a story that's on the front of the Daily Telegraph, because there was a meeting in Brussels that was very bombastically shut down. Actually, Nigel Farage was on stage as the police came in to shut this particular meeting down, a Conservative conference featuring Nigel Farage and Suella Braverman. Now, what's interesting is that Nigel Farage has now written, you know, a comment piece in the Daily Telegraph saying, you know, this is the rise of Soviet-style communism. You know, this is the lack of free speech. This, you know, all of the typical kind of language that he uses. And what I think is interesting, and is I wonder if the reasons for this meeting being shut down. So the Brussels police sort of said that they didn't want hate speech, and it was about reducing the risk of violence and so on. If the closing down of the meeting actually gave the conference the sort of PR boost that it wouldn't have had, because I'm not sure anyone would have heard about it.
One meeting that did go ahead was the conference on humanitarian issues in Sudan. That was, I think, a couple of days ago. Tell us about this, because it was the anniversary of the first anniversary of the outbreak of war in Sudan.
That's right. So on Monday, the Paris conference, there was a sort of donor conference bringing together delegates from around the EU and around the world to try to raise more money for Sudan, for the humanitarian crisis, and also to get conversation going around a cessation of the conflict, of the fighting. What the real good thing that's come out of it is that about $2 billion have been pledged, which, you know, the ask or the gap was about $2.7 billion. And before the meeting, only 6% of that had been pledged. So it is good to see that there is more money. The question of how much and how quickly will that money reach the ground is different. But it is, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to speak about this was because Sudan has kind of not really been, there's a lot going on in the world, so it's not really been at the forefront of international media and at politicians' minds. But this conference, I think, is hopefully ensuring that Sudan is at least, you know, on the policy table again.
Yasmin, thank you very much indeed. That's Yasmin Abdel-Majid. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The US and its allies plan fresh sanctions against Iran over its unprecedented attack on Israel, seeking to dissuade Israel from a major escalation as its war cabinet is set to meet for a third time today to decide a response. Myanmar's detained former leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from prison to house arrest. Suu Kyi, who's 78, has been detained by the Myanmar military since it overthrew her government in a 2021 coup. And Haiti's government has named the members of a transitional council set to take power when Prime Minister Ariel Henry steps down, inching closer to putting in place measures that could restore security in the violence-wracked country. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. In 1967, the first successful human-to-human heart transplant surgery was carried out by cardiac surgeon Christian Barnard in South Africa. The country was hailed at being at the cutting edge of medical science. But now, nearly 85% of the nation's 62 million people have no medical insurance and rely on a decrepit public health system. Section 27 of the country's constitution states that everyone has the right to access healthcare. The National Health Insurance Bill, which has been passed by the National Assembly and awaits presidential approval, is the manifestation of this provision. But though similar, are universal access to healthcare and the NHI, the National Health Insurance Bill, the same thing? Well, I'm joined now by Elna Schultz, who is a journalist and a broadcaster based in Johannesburg. Elna, welcome to Monocle Radio. What is the current status of the NHI Bill?
Hello, and I'm so excited to talk about this because it is on the forefront of my mind as a person who works in health journalism, and really most South Africans, I think, because as you rightly mentioned, healthcare is a right for us all, but that doesn't mean we're actually able to access it. So we are waiting with bated breath to see when the president signs it. And he even joked in a recent address to the nation that he's just, and I quote, looking for a pen to sign, even though he has signed several other bills in the time after that. So we're all wondering when this is actually going to happen. But of course, that's just a formality. It has been passed, so it has been decided on, so to say. And once it will actually be signed into law, it's going to be really several years. We're looking at an incremental implementation that's going to look over multiple years as it becomes reality. But really the important thing is the closer we get to implementation and this becoming a reality, the more people are saying this NHI is really not a good idea as it stands now. And the amount of people who have a problem with it seem to almost be more than the people who are for it.
So what exactly does the bill provide for, and who's for it and against it?
Yes. So in basic terms, as with many other countries, it's a fund from which the government and would buy healthcare services. So it would mean that everybody, in a sense, gets funded in the same way, and it would be funded by taxes and various other sources. So in a sense, it's trying to equalize healthcare in the country. Now, the problem is, as lovely as that sounds, it really isn't clear where the funding exactly is going to be coming from and whether this is feasible, because you can have great plans, but is that really manageable? So basically, all of the analysts, and we're talking here about companies, individuals, politicians, even the South African Medical Association has said that the country is not ready for this in practice. So really, a large amount of people have spoken out against this and said, well, the idea is good. The funding would mean huge tax increases that seem unmanageable. We already have quite a high tax burden. There would be additional contributions. And a big problem that I and many people have is that I'm not really seeing how the NHI is going to solve the problems that we already have in the healthcare system, which we can talk about a bit more. So the medical aids that already exist, the medical schemes are also quite upset. They are worried that they will now be relegated and that it will mean that people who are paying for medical aids can't access all the healthcare they need. And of course, the public health care system might get more funding, but that doesn't necessarily mean it will be improved.
Absolutely. Elna, thank you very much indeed. That's Elna Schultz there. You're with Monocle Radio. It's It is 7.38 in London, 8.38 in Milan, and that's where we are heading now. All week, our team is on the ground at the Design and Furniture Fair Salone del Mobile, broadcasting from our pop-up studio at House of Switzerland. Another brand also on full display in Milan this year is the luxury manufacturer of home appliances, Gaggenau. Founded in Germany in 1683, this is a brand that knows the importance of heritage and designing long-lasting products. This year, Gaggenau has put together an architectural installation called the Elevation of Gravity as a way of displaying their latest connection. Monocle's design editor, Nick Manise, caught up with the managing director, Peter Goertz, and with the head of design, Sven Bakker. He started by asking Sven to talk about their presence at Salone this year.
It's not that obvious when you come in. It's not so much about kitchen appliances. It's more that of the things that you don't see that are under the surface, about what really luxury means at home, what you can feel with all your senses. So if you have the time, just come to Villanecki and enjoy the show.
Fascinating, Peter. I mean, Sven just talked there about experience more so than product. Why put the focus on how we feel rather than how something works?
First of all, it works perfectly on a professional kitchen principle for us as standard. And then you all have a tool. But the question is, what do you want to do with the tool, and how is your private living organized, and how does it feel? And what we want to do is to integrate ourselves in the best way into a private living situation and not just having functional tools for cooking.
How do you strike that balance at Gaggenau between the functional and then the beauty and the experience? What are those discussions that you're having in your design studios?
Engineers tend to do it very practical, and designers sometimes are able to do it very in a beautiful way. And to getting this together, you have the perfect tool for cooking, integrated best in your home and supporting your lifestyle. It's not easy to balance. But if you get that in a very elegant way, you're happy to enter your kitchen space and you can work with the tool that you have there. That's what we try to do.
How do you get everyone to work together?
I always say, actually, it's designers, not just a cherry on the top. So you just don't do the execution of the engineering, and then the designers are coming doing it, making it nice. It's more that we're working together since the very beginning, having some fights, having discussions about a lot of details. But if you really work closely together and do a collaboration, then the end result is like perfect.
And Peter, from, I guess, a brand perspective, obviously Gaggenau is known for making products that stand the test of time, and you've been around since the 1800s. I mean, what about, I guess, the values today? What defines the work that you're doing today? What do you want people to know Gaggenau for?
I would say Gaggenau should stand for a long-lasting value experience which you have at your home whilst you are cooking. And you really have to experience it. It can be an aesthetical experience. You are at home, you look, and it can be a haptical experience when you touch something and it feels good. It can be a small interaction with the user interface where you think, oh, that's precise. This gives value to things.
What is also kind of fascinating to me about the work that you're doing is, yes, you're making a product, but you're also kind of, you're making an architecture in a way. It's sort of architecture within architecture. It's not like a chair that you can move around a room, or a piece of cutlery if we're going to go something smaller scale. It's really something that's quite permanent and quite fixed. I mean, how do you think about that? Are you going out and you're measuring people's homes? Are you looking at the scale of things? Are you peering through windows? How do you make this architecture within an architecture?
I would say it's a question of freedom which we give to architects to do things they would like to do. So you cannot figure out kitchens. Obviously, there are a certain percentage this size, a certain percentage that size, but each situation at home is different. So you need somebody who's taking care about this, and it's an architect who is doing this work. What we can do is we can offer an assortment of products which can be combined in different ways, which can be built in different situations. The architects have a lot of flexibility in order to do their project.
Why should somebody invest in their kitchen? Why turn to Gaggenau and come to you guys?
The answer is quite simple, and you gave it. A kitchen is something very fixed in your home. If you want to have something which is long-lasting, where you say 10 years, 20 years later, it still looks good. When you look for something which is not outdated after 2 years due to some technical feature innovation or some stripes here or another material there, then we are fond of Gaggenau. So we try to do long-lasting things. We don't believe in changing designs, features of products on an annual or a biannual basis. We do this in a long-term perspective. So if you buy an oven, it should look great and it should work well in 20 years.
We did an interview for the Salone del Mobile newspaper, which people can pick up on newsstands now. But one of the things that you spoke about in that was the idea of luxury and how that works as a kitchen brand. Like, how important is, I guess, a luxurious experience to what you're doing at Gaggenau?
It's quite important because that's the reason why people are looking for us. They want to have something which adds value, which adds worth to them, and that's what the whole thing is about. There is aesthetics from the product, but as well from the brand. There is a lot of graphic aesthetics around Gaggenau. There are pictures you want to bring across, which somehow are memorized by people in order to make this special feeling visible.
I guess just finally, I want to kind of throw it out to both of you. Sven, why come and visit you at Villanecki?
You can experience something with all of your senses. When you have never been there before, it's a beautiful place. Coming to the villa with the pool, the whole scenery is so nice and beautiful, being out of the bus from Milan. When you enter the Gaggenau installation, it's quite calm. There's some music playing. There we show where we are today. And then we have some kind of a rotunda installation where the future is shown. We are curious to see that, where Gaggenau is going to. And it's a very nice experience, totally different from what you see here in Milan.
Amazing. And Peter, give us the pitch.
When you want to see the future of appliances, then you have to come. You see three kinds of products, which are, let's say, the new level where we want to play and where we will play in terms of functionality, in terms of aesthetics of products. And this is about gravity, and this is the elevation of gravity. We are right now a brand which has gravity, but we put this on a new level. And that's the elevation of gravity.
Sven Bakker and Peter Goertz of Gaggenau speaking with Monocle's Nick Manise at this year's Salone del Mobile. Now, if you're in town in Milan, do stop by our pop-up studio. It's at House of Switzerland. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Have a look at the latest television news, and joining me to do just that is Scott Bryan, who's the TV critic and broadcaster. Scott, let's start with Netflix, because Dan Lin has taken over as the new film chief there. Tell us more.
Well, I mean, I think, he is the new big boss at Netflix in regards to film. But I think what is sort of piquing a lot of people's interest today is perhaps a change of strategy at Netflix. Because, of course, Netflix has been a huge global player in big TV releases. And, of course, have had those big sensational shows that everyone's been talking about, dating all the way back to House of Cards. But when it comes to film, it's surprising. It can be a bit hit and miss. They have had some really successful films, maybe in sort of the Octane thriller, for example, Ryan Reynolds and Chris Hemsworth, those sort of big action films. But they've also had a lot of money spent on big projects, maybe in the idea that it would be a big Oscar win, only for it to not really work out for them. I think the most recent example was Maestro, which is starring and directing, directed by Bradley Cooper, which cost around $80 million to make. It was nominated for 7 Oscars, but didn't win any. So The idea with Dan Lynn coming in is perhaps a change of direction, less money given and less big sort of prestige sort of films, maybe aiming to get big Oscars, maybe not watched by many people, but have lavish budgets, attracting the likes of Martin Scorsese, and more towards tailored specific films, maybe less sort of Oscar worthy, but perhaps more successful.
Mm, interesting. I also love the photograph of him. He is about 12. let's talk about the Beatles, their film Let It Be. Now, that was made in 1970 and it really hasn't been seen since.
It hasn't been seen since. It's sort of become a bit like a bootleg for the Beatles. So it's essentially been, it was a film that was released in 1970 and that captured the recording sessions of the band's final album. It was released, weirdly enough, after the band had actually broken up. None of the band members actually attended the screening when the film was actually released. And it's been one of those films that have been sort of become a big obsession for Beatles fans, primarily because it hasn't been available, but also just because you're able to, if you watch that film, sort of start to see the cracks appearing within the group. So it hasn't been on release since. You've only really been able to go and get it on VHS. But now, following the very big success of the Peter Jackson film that was out a couple of years ago, which uses actually quite a lot of the film footage that was unused for the original documentary made by Michael Lindsay Hogg. It's going to be actually restored and available on Disney Plus. And I think it sort of signifies maybe another resurgence of the band, the Beatles, of course. I mean, of course, Paul McCartney is hugely popular with, I think, younger generations as much as those who are fans of the Beatles back at the time. But we've also got, of course, there's the 8-hour Peter Jackson film, and there's going to be a new film, well, four films by Sam Mendes, which will be charting the band from each perspective of each band member from the Beatles. And that's going to be out here in a few years. So whether I think it's you've got an 8-hour TV show, you've got this new series and potentially four films on the way on the Beatles. So it sort of shows that there's a lot of love for the band still.
Absolutely. And finally, let's look at changes to the Disney Channel.
Yes, so this is an interesting one. Disney Plus, there's speculation that they could be launching TV channels on their streaming platform. And that might raise a bit of eyebrows because, of course, Disney Plus is a huge streamer that has had sort of mixed success in terms of whether it's profitable, but essentially has loads of shows on demand. And, of course, this comes not long after they've been closing a lot of their TV channels around the world. I think there's been this idea that the future's all going to be streaming, and here they are potentially launching TV channels again. I think this shows perhaps that maybe in a world where there is unlimited amount of programs that we could watch, that maybe viewers actually do really want curation. They do want the shows that they actually want to have, would have a finite amount of shows presented to them that they can just browse rather than having to spend endless hours scrolling through various menus. And it sort of replicates the success of the British domestic channel ITV, which has have a sort of many different online channels. They're called fast channels, and they are airing online all day, including non-stop 24 hours a day Midsummer Murders. You can see Martin McCutcheon being crushed by a giant wheel of cheese whenever you want.
And these new channels, for instance, they might just be a Star Wars channel or Marvel series channel.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I think the idea you can watch a Pixar film, put the children in front of it, and then never have to be sort of browsing again. But I think it is kind of maybe changing the idea that linear traditional TV is going to be on the way out and won't be replaced with anything. I think we're going to be having a happy medium.
Absolutely. Scott, thank you very much indeed. That's Scott Bryant there. And you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. It's 100 days before the start of the Olympics in Paris. As the city prepares to host the event, let's catch up with Agnès Poirier, a journalist and author of Notre Dame, the Soul of France. Agnès, 100 days to go and the torch has been lit. This just really starts everything all off, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, if you are Parisian, you hear about the Olympic Games, you know, on a daily basis. And I would say that, yes, there is the symbolic weight of the 100-day countdown. Also, it's quite lovely, I must say. I don't know if you saw the high priestess in Greece lighting the torch, and suddenly you're brought back a thousand of years. And but we do hope that, you know, it's going to go uphill, and it will be better and better, because as Parisians, we're just in a state of not panic, but we're shivering at the idea that something might go awry and, you know, not according to plans.
Mm. And of course, that is the big worry, because security is a big concern. The opening ceremony is the first ever to appear outside of a stadium, but Emmanuel Macron has revealed a plan B if the security risks are too high.
Well, I mean, that's the problem, obviously, with the international situation, Ukraine, Russia, and now the Middle East, and this sort of heightened alert for terrorist attacks. But not only, actually, because, you know, activism and militancy of eco activists, for instance, but also the ultra left or the ultra right has reached some, you know, pretty radical state or level everywhere in the world. So the worry is multifaceted, if you'd like. And I don't know, perhaps it was too ambitious in the first place to do something that had never been done before. That is to say, it's so easier, so much easier for security when you do organize a ceremony, opening ceremony as this one, in a closed area like a stadium. But of course, Paris being Paris, they wanted to do something that had never been done before, and that parade on 6 kilometers of the Seine River, you know, with 11,000 athletes on barges. And of course, it leaves it quite vulnerable to drone attacks, for instance. So yes, apparently there's a plan B and there's a plan C and there might be a plan D. President Macron talked about, for instance, moving the opening ceremony to the Trocadero, which is right across the Eiffel Tower, or just to do it more classically in the Stade de France. But the organizers replied that actually there's only one plan. It's plan A. So they will have to, you know, to have a meeting. But of course, as President Macron said, we're not going to reveal anything, and we'll take it in real time. So hopefully, touch wood, I'm touching wood, everything will go well and according to plan.
And of course, the other hope is that the Olympic truce is upheld. What's that?
Well, I mean, it's a tradition, of course, that peace should reign in the world during the Olympic Games. And it's something that President Macron has been working hard on. It actually, the Chinese President Xi Jinping is coming to Paris early in May. And President Macron is actually relying on him to play his part. And he's working behind doors to make sure that there are no fighting in Ukraine, for instance, but Russia has already said that Ukraine will take advantage to regroup and to rearm, and that they are not really keen on a truce. So yes, one lives in hope.
Mm. Now, one of the things about this particular iteration of the Games is that there's been very few new builds for it. What there has been, though, is renovation. And Macron has visited the newly renovated Grand Palais. Tell us about that.
Well, the Grand Palais was built for the Universal Exhibition of 1900, and it wasn't supposed to remain like the Eiffel Tower. So it needed a big renovation, which it never had since 1900. So I don't know if you've ever been to the Grand Palais. It's wonderful, and it has this glass structure and metal structure. What they did is that they created more safety exits, for instance, and they want to be able to welcome almost almost 10,000 people until now. We could only welcome 5,000 people. And this is where the fencing competition, but also the taekwondo competitions will take place. It looks quite amazing from the pictures that I've seen.
And that's Agnès Poirier. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Globalist. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Carlotta Ribello and Chris Chermack. Our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Lily Austin. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and The Briefing is live at midday in London. And The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. And earlier in the show, we made reference to the Christos Tsioklos book, The Slap. It was a huge hit around the world. And there is an interview with Christos currently up. It's our current Meet the Writers programme, but you can get that wherever you get your podcasts, really. I can tell you that coming up, a brand new edition on Sunday is with Zainab Badawi, who, of course, is one of the best known journalists working in the British media today. She has a new book called An African History of Africa, From the Dawn of Humanity to Independence. And that's something you can hear from noon London time on Meet the Writers on Monocle Radio. And that's it. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.